It's the weekend, which means it's time for Jill on Money, the show that makes money fun and just happens to answer all your financial questions. Here's your host, Jill Schlesinger.
Welcome to Jill on Money. Well, I mean, by now the Equifax data breach is really sinking in. And maybe we should have always anticipated it. That's what our guest, Adam Levin, told me a while back. I conducted this interview earlier this year, but my gosh, he is quite prescient. Adam Levin is the author of the book Swiped, which is now available in paperback. And this is such an important book, and he really does boil down so many of these identity theft issues into an easy-to-digest way. The book is organized around different problems caused by identity theft, whether it's financial, criminal, medical, family, whatever. But it's a practical book, and it really has helped me figure out how to give good advice to everyone about online security. Adam, I always love to say this because you're a former director of the New Jersey Division of Consumer Affairs, which I guess leads to many sort of funny jokes about, you know, either Sopranos references, Chris Christie, Bridgegate. But you probably had your arms around a lot of things as the division in the Division of Consumer Affairs in New Jersey, my guess. But you're here because your book Swiped is now out in paperback, which is so exciting. So I wanted to bring you on the show to talk a little bit about identity theft and tell me, what is it that we need to worry about when it comes to protecting our identity?
Well, first of all, let me start by saying I may have had my arms around many things when I was at Consumer Affairs, but Chris Christie was not one of them.
Your arms are not big enough.
I do. That's true. It would have been an issue. Lovable fellow, but anyway.
Oh, go crazy.
So, well, I think we're still going to see the old standbys in identity theft. I mean, certainly phishing is going to be probably still the biggest problem that people face. Clicking on links, ransomware, and all of the things associated with it. Every possible scam that people can come up with, because scammers are incredibly creative people, and they're counting on the fact that we're distracted because we have day jobs, and we are their day job.
Okay, the idea of phishing and clicking on links, all of this used to be like, oh, we're just going to get your, you know, we're going to get into your credit card account and we're going to go to Best Buy and charge a bunch of stuff. But that's actually not what the tax fraudsters are looking for. They just want your name and your social. Is that right?
Yeah, they'd like your name, your date of birth, your social, your address wouldn't hurt either.
Right.
And what they do is then they file as fast as they possibly can, because the goal is to get to the tax man first. And you find out that you have tax issues three ways. First, you attempt to file a tax return and you're blocked because somebody using your social security number has filed ahead of you. Or you're waiting for your refund and it never shows up. You call the IRS, they say, but we issued your refund. Unfortunately, you weren't the you that they issued the refund to. And the third is you get a deficiency notice from the service telling you you woefully underreported your income because, unbeknownst to you, someone using your social security number got work and their income is being reported to your social security number.
And so how can you... All right, so that's like kind of just preposterous and annoying and all of that. And the IRS doesn't have a lot of money, but they are putting in more filters to try to figure out where there's weird behavior. Is that right? Because remember, if you recall, years ago, I called you up because my dad had an experience around tax fraud.
Right.
And I said, hey, you know, Albie tried to file his... Albie got a call from the IRS. They literally called his accountant and said, you've never gotten a refund in 45 years of filing, and you got a refund. Is there something wrong? And it was a fraudulent return that was filed.
Right.
But that's after the fact. The identity had been stolen. His social had been compromised. And there were a series of steps that we had to take. So how can we protect ourselves? Just file as early as you can? Or are there other things we should be doing?
Well, unfortunately, you have to file basically as early as you possibly can. And it's because there's a flaw in the system anyway, and that is they don't end up matching the returns to the information from the Social Security Administration and employers until July. So as a result, a great deal of the refund process by congressional mandate is done much earlier. It's supposed to be 21 days if you file electronically, no more than 6 weeks if you file by snail mail. So the whole purpose is sort of get it out there, get it back to the taxpayer. Unfortunately, oftentimes it ends up not going back to the taxpayer.
It goes to the fraudster.
That's right. So the things that you should be doing to protect yourself in general from identity theft, which is you minimize your risk of exposure, you monitor, you have a plan to manage the damage, are the same things that would apply with the IRS.
These are Adam Levin's 3 M's. How do you minimize your exposure? Let's start with the first M.
Well, you don't carry your Social Security card. Unfortunately, for those of us who are over the age of 65, we are de facto carrying our Social Security card.
Because it's on the Medicare card.
That's correct. Now, there is a law that's been passed that's phasing it out over the next few years. I hope we live as long as to see it happen. So what I suggest to people is, unless you know you're going specifically to a medical provider that day, the way you deal with it is make a copy of your Medicare card, redact all but one or two numbers, and write on the back your emergency contact number, and make sure that person has your Medicaid or Medicare number.
Oh, that's smart, because you know you're social anyway.
Right.
So that's okay.
But
that
in the
smart.
Event that, you know, you fainted or you've had a heart attack and you're not conscious, at least they can have somebody they can call right away.
Okay. So minimize, don't carry your social around, don't broadcast your Medicare card. What else can minimize your exposure?
Covered your information, which means if you are a victim of what I call the pantheon of ishings, which is phishing, dear cardholder, dear member, dear account holder, spear phishing, dear Jill, vishing, that's when you get a call from what you think is the bank, and they start asking you questions, and if the questions go anywhere beyond, we just want to confirm these transactions because maybe they're suspicious, the minute they attempt to get you to authenticate yourself, hang up. And then there is smishing, which is SMS or text-based phishing. And that's where you get a text that says your account has been frozen. And the only way that you can thaw it is that you have to click on the link, go to a site, provide information that would re-authenticate you, and then they will thaw your account. Unfortunately, you are not thawing your account. You are basically freezing your life because these guys are going to come after you and destroy it.
Oh, God. This is horrible. Okay, so when you're minimizing your exposure, it's also about, like as you said, protecting your identity, being careful not to click on links you don't recognize.
Right.
Remember that the IRS is not sending you a text message.
And they're not calling you.
And they're not calling you, exactly.
Although with the new debt collector law, possibly so, but that's a while off. But the other thing is never, the simple rule of thumb, never authenticate yourself to anyone who calls you. Go to the specific website. Make the phone call to the organization. Confirm they are real. Do not use the phone number they email you. Even if it is the right email or phone number, don't do it. Confirm it independently. Flip your credit or debit card. Read the phone number on back. Call customer service. Then if they ask you to authenticate yourself, it's not illogical because they don't know who you are.
We'll get back to our interview with Adam Levin, the author of Swiped, in just a minute. You're listening to Jill on Money, 855-411-JILL. Send us an email, askjill@jillonmoney.com. We'll be right back.
From rookie investors to savvy veterans, Jill Schlesinger is here to help you. Call now, 855-411-JILL, or email askjill@jillonmoney.com.
You're back with Jill on Money. You know, even before the Equifax data breach, I have really been trying to hammer home that managing your personal identity should just be part of what you are doing in your overall financial life. And oftentimes in our financial encounters with other professionals, you know, we have a little healthy bit of skepticism. And somehow or other, we lose that when it comes to our online identity, our sharing in social media. You know, our guest, Adam Levin, has always said to me that there are a number of hackers that are out there. They're creative, they're determined, they can take pieces of your information from lots of different sources, and they can undermine your entire financial life. And what you need to protect yourself starts with a healthy dose of skepticism. And I think that that's actually kind of like, be skeptical is your number one piece of advice. Like, you know, just don't trust that someone's calling, emailing, texting you for any other reason except to get stuff from you, get something from you.
To paraphrase Ronald Reagan,
yes,
never trust and always verify.
I love that. And two-factor authentication is even better for you.
Two-factor authentication is great. That's where, examples, you start to log into a site. It says unfamiliar device. It will put up security questions. Incidentally, when you create security questions, lie about the answers. Or it will send a code to your cell phone, which you then have to enter in order to continue the log on.
How do you feel about the putting passwords in the cloud? A lot of people are using password generators, and then they're storing all of their passwords on some app or system that's on the cloud. I always get a little nervous about this because, I mean, look, if a hacker can get into the IRS website, right, or into a big financial institution's website, why couldn't they get to a cloud-based website that is supposedly protecting my information?
Well, not to be Debbie Downer here,
but
the truth of the matter is that hackers can get anywhere they ultimately want to get.
Yeah.
But you can't live in a log cabin on Loon Lake and off the grid. So if we're going to be part of the real world, you kind of buy your ticket and take your chances. Password generators, password managers are way better than we are. Now, you could also take your passwords, download them onto an encrypted thumb drive, but then you have to remember where you put the thumb drive.
What about writing them down in my desk?
Really bad idea.
Why?
Well, you know, if someone's wandering by your desk and decides to take a souvenir.
No, not at my work desk. What if it's like, what if your password is written down and it's in your house, your apartment, your dwelling? And I get it. If someone broke in, that's the same thing. But,
well, they don't even have to break in because, first of all, I mean, I assume you trust your family. That's good.
Yeah.
But remember that a lot of people float through your house, your apartment, wherever you live.
Right.
Whether they are the cleaning crowd, whether they're visiting on the holidays, whether they are fixing something for
right.
you.
Right. Point well taken.
So, you know, you never know. So unless you're going to keep them in a really secure location, like a safe.
Right.
Don't do that.
Okay.
Now, you could, put them in an encrypted thumb drive, or you could create a passphrase. Now, example, but don't use it, because this is example everyone uses.
1, 2, 3?
The 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 was an Ashley Madison favorite.
There you go. Password 1, 2, 3.
That's right. But what you should do, let's see, the quick brown fox jumped over the fence. Now, you got to remember how you spell every word in there. You could do the first letter. You could also put a couple letters in front to remind you of the website, some numbers in back, but that requires effort and that requires memory, where password managers really don't.
And do you think that when you sort of are looking big picture about this, beyond minimizing your exposure and having strong passwords and two-factor authentication, your second M is monitor your accounts, which I think is sort of intriguing to me because I find that even when we learned about that Wells Fargo scam, that some of it was in the accounts, but not all of it. But a lot of people just don't look at their credit card accounts, their bank accounts. They don't look at the details. And I imagine that that's what you're talking about when you talk about monitoring your accounts.
Well, it's a variety of things. You monitor your credit by going to annualcreditreport.com, getting a free copy of your credit report.
Once a year, free. Right.
Come to sites like credit.com, Karma, Sesame, those sites where you get free scores. And that's important. They're updated frequently because if your score drops, could be an indicator of a number of things. You didn't pay your bill on time, you're using too much credit, or you're a victim of identity theft. Check your accounts on a daily basis. Some people say, I don't have the time. Fine. Then sign up for transactional monitoring alerts. They're offered by financial services institutions and credit card companies. They notify you anytime there's activity in your account. Since stolen cards are sold by zip code, you have a better shot of seeing a transaction that doesn't make sense than the bank. Then there's more sophisticated forms of monitoring that are available that you can buy that have even instant alerts that notify you the moment someone's attempting to open an account in your name.
Okay, now let's presume the worst has happened. Something bad happens. And number three, our third M, is manage the damage. The first thing that happens, what do? You go to identitytheft.gov? What do you file a report? If your identity is stolen, what's step one?
Step one is really go to the fraud department of a credit reporting company and put a fraud alert on your file, or do what you should have done before, which is freeze your credit.
Okay.
Now, you do that with each of the three bureaus. A fraud alert, you only need to go to one. Police report, very important. You don't have one, it's a non-starter.
Really? So you have to go and deal with that. You go to your local police and that's it.
Go to your local police. Probably they're not going to investigate, but at the very least, what you want is the report, because you're going to have to be able to supply that report as an indicator that you're having a problem. Because when you don't have a police report, creditors, credit reporting agencies, government agencies don't believe you.
Oh, that's amazing.
And the reason why identity theft, for instance, is so horrible when it occurs within the family group is because people don't want to rat out family members.
Right.
And if you're not going to file a police report, they think you're either an identity thief trying to manipulate the system or a credit repair company trying to manipulate the system.
Okay, file a police report. Do your identitytheft.gov, contact the credit reporting agencies. What's the difference between freezing your credit and what's the other alternative?
Fraud alert.
What's the two different?
A fraud alert tells a prospective creditor that they need to authenticate your identity before they extend you credit because there's an issue. A credit freeze allows no one, including you, to access your credit for the purposes of getting new credit until it's thawed. So you freeze and then you thaw.
Well, wait a second. So does that mean that you should, if you had a freeze on your, let's assume you've got all the credit you need. You bought your house, you got your car, you got all the credit cards you want. Should everyone freeze their credit for the heck of it?
Wouldn't be a bad idea.
Because there's no downside except unless you have to unfreeze it to then have something new occur, correct?
That is correct.
Is there any other downside to freezing?
Well, it's a little cumbersome and it costs.
How much?
It could cost you 10 in, 10 out, depending upon your age and the state. It could be less, depending upon your status of whether or not you've been a victim or not. It could be less. But the truth of the matter is, it is something that people should seriously consider. It's not the silver bullet. It's not going to stop medical identity theft or criminal identity theft. Because of children, it still may not necessarily get it, because a lot of states still don't let you freeze it, and the bureaus don't necessarily want to do it without the reality that there has been an identity theft.
Mm-hmm.
But a credit freeze is more comprehensive. The great thing about it is because you do it with three agencies. If you're going to a creditor other than someone for a mortgage where they pull all three, you can ask them, which bureau do you pull a report from? Because I freeze my credit, and you could thaw the credit with just that one bureau and then refreeze it.
We'll get back to our interview with Adam Levin. He is the author of Swiped, which is now available in paperback. Go buy it during the break. If you've got a financial question, 855-411-JILL, send us an email, askjill@jillonmoney.com.
Young, old, it doesn't matter. She's here to help you. Back to Jill on Money with Jill Schlesinger.
Friday night, I crashed your party.
You're back with Jill on Money. This is the program that takes the mystery out of your financial life. And we are talking about identity theft and security and best practices and all those things you hate to actually consider because it's a complete pain in the neck. Then again, so is cleaning up after that whole Equifax data breach, which is a nightmare. 143 million people, meaning that you've got better than 50-50 odds that you were hacked or that your information's out there. And that, by the way, it is likely to live on the dark web for some time to come. So with that information out there, and with your nutty kids sharing every single bit of their personal lives, and maybe by extension yours, that could mean that in addition to your general talk about money, you know, which is right up there with like your sex and drugs talk, you will need to be talking to your kids about being a little bit smarter about identity and what they are sharing. That is what our guest, Adam Levin, says. Let's talk about child. You just mentioned it, child identity theft. This blew my mind when you first told me about it, that it's estimated that up to 400,000 children become victims of identity theft. How is this possible?
Every year. Yes.
Every
and not only that, but it is a fact now that 10% of all foster children become victims of identity theft because their data is on a card that's passed from family to family to family.
Oh.
And unfortunately, they're very, very exposed. There is nothing more delicious to an identity thief than the identity of a child because the Social Security number is pristine. There's been no activity. Kids are not checking their credit reports. Parents don't necessarily do anything about checking or protecting their children's credit. And as a thief, you could literally have a 17-year run until that child grows up and starts looking for, let's say, a college loan, their first car. Maybe they want to rent an apartment off campus, and they're going to run a credit report just because they want to know if there's an issue. So that's why it's so important to keep track of your child's credit.
So when you're pulling your own credit at annualcreditreport.com, you should do it for each of your children's. Whoever has whichever kid has a social, you should pull it for that kid every year as well?
Yeah, and assume that every child has a social.
Yeah.
This is pretty much what we do now because we have children as dependents on tax returns.
Right.
And by the way, this is a particularly wonderful thing for an identity thief when they're looking to do a false tax return or they're looking to get fraudulent refunds is they want those children's Social Security numbers.
This is unbelievable.
No, it really is. And you should go to Annual Credit Report. If they're below the age of 13, it's recommended you go directly to the credit reporting agency. Every one of the three on their websites has specific procedures that you use in order to confirm that you are the parent or the guardian and information they need about the child. And then they will, one will actually create a report and freeze it. The other two want to actually have an indication there has been an identity theft before they freeze. About 23 states permit a freezing for children's credit. So we have a bit of a way to go on that. But it is a big and growing issue and can devastate young people.
Adam, so much of our lives is lived in social media. And I'm wondering where we are going wrong on social. And I'm not just talking about kids, but adults too. But what tips do you have for managing your identity, protecting yourself in light of the world being sort of open and connected via social media?
Well, the real danger with social media is that we fling so much information out there about ourselves and our children that we are giving identity thieves the breadcrumbs they need in order to recreate us for the purpose of exploiting our identities.
And that includes maybe some hints on passwords?
Well, first of all, yes, because the problem is that oftentimes the answers to security questions or password information is included in facts about your lives, your favorite color, your dog, the street you grew up on, your high school mascot, where you went to high school, your mother's maiden name, your father's middle name. These are the kinds of things that people also look to get out of you on quizzes on social networking sites.
And so when you're on social media, I understand that most people are, you know, they'll be on Facebook. And I can't believe they have their birth date. A lot of people will say use the month and the day. Some people say don't put anything up there. Look, you've got young kids now. You're not going to be able to, like, manage every single thing. So what is the message that we should give to our kids around this?
The message we should give to our kids is, look, you, my son or daughter, can be a wise consumer and protect your identity. Or you can be a weapon of individual destruction as well as mass destruction in the household by clicking on links and giving away too much information. And even to the point of something as simple as look at your cell phone, your smartphone, go to location services and disable them. Because when you take digital photographs, if you haven't disabled location services, there is a code placed on your picture. And anyone who is relatively smart can figure out where it was taken and when it was taken. And for instance, young people love to go, here's my new car, here's my new watch, here's my new credit card. Some people actually do that. Here's my new piece of art. And what they don't realize is when that picture is posted and that geotag is on it, you are telling a thief where you live, where this valuable is, and effectively what they're going to need to haul it away.
It's amazing. So, Adam, last question that I just want to get out of you, and that is there any way that we can expect that technology will work in consumers' favor, or so that we get ahead of the fraudsters? Is there something that's going to happen? Is it going to be retina, thumbprints, this kind of thing? I mean, what is going on that will eventually help us out of this bind? Because it seems like we're always playing catch up to the bad guys.
The more that we move toward biometric authentication, whether it be fingerprints, retinal scans, the actual beat of your heart, the flow of your blood, these are the kinds of things that they're working on so that we can more precisely identify an individual and make sure that each time that individual shows up, it's truly that individual with whom we are communicating. We'll get there, but it's really going to take a while because the bad guys are incredibly sophisticated, creative, and persistent. They're not going away. And frankly, we are their day job.
Thanks so much to Adam Levin. Go get his book, Swiped: How to Protect Yourself in a World Full of Scammers, Phishers, and Identity Thieves. It's available in paperback. And if you've got a financial question, 855-411-JILL. Send us an email, askjill@jillonmoney.com. We'll be right back.
From rookie investors to savvy veterans, Jill Schlesinger is here to help you. Call now, 855-411-JILL, or email askjill@jillonmoney.com.
You're back with Jill on Money. This is the show that takes the mystery out of your financial life. I'm Jill Schlesinger. Mark is running the show. And our phone number is 855-411-JILL. Send us an email, askjill@jillonmoney.com. Hey, Mark, where are we on Twitter? Did we get to like a milestone or anything? I'm on the verge of 14,000. That doesn't seem, I feel like I'm stuck, man. Oh, Mark says when we kind of started getting him involved in my social life. Meaning not my social life, but my social media life. I was like at 11,000, so he's taking credit for that. How about you get me to 20? Oh, all right. All right, let's stay to get a question here. Wilbur writes, I have a $150,000 Northwestern Mutual Comp Life Insurance policy that I bought when I was 25. I'm now 77. I started off paying $1,500 premiums annually, but for the past 15 years, the dividend of around $2,100 of the cash value of $72,000 has been paying for the premium. I think I'm at a critical age where the insurance company thinks that dying will become more of a probability. Well, I don't think that the insurance company thinks that. I think that actually it is a probability. As I approach 85 or 90, I know the protection will be there, but the cash value will be dwindling. My question to you is, at my age, do you think I should just leave the cash value insurance coverage alone and ride it out until I die? We are well off, and I don't need the insurance for death expenses. Do you think I should leave things alone? What would you do? I look forward to your columns because we seem to think alike. This is Wilbur in San Diego. Okay, this is such a hard one because at some point you're like, I've had it for this long, why not? And if you said that you needed the cash value, and I don't know how much cash value is in there, I might just, you know, pull the money out. But it doesn't sound like you need it. So, again, this is permanent life insurance. It's in place for your whole life. That's why they call it whole life insurance. But, you know, you probably, like, if given my druthers, what I would love is that I could wind the clock back and that when you were 60, you could take the money out. But now, you know, you don't want to blow the policy out. You probably have a tax liability because you've probably actually put more money in than the policy's worth. So I might just leave it alone, ride it out, and the cash value will dwindle, but the insurance will be in place and it'll just add to your estate. Make sure that you have all of your estate planning documents. You're going to do that, right? That's important. Be sure that you do that. And then, of course, make sure that the beneficiary in the policy is whomever you want it to be, whether that's your spouse, your kids, whoever. It does make it a little bit easier. I just had did a speaking engagement recently, and during the course of the speaking engagement, one of the things that I talked about was how it's really hard sometimes to get into these topics with your family. Listen to this email I got, by the way. Mark, you'll like this. Thank you so much for taking the time to give us your wonderful financial presentation. Numbers are still so scary for us. You always have a thoughtful and funny approach that even with the worst case of arithmophobia, we all feel more confident the next time we have to make decisions about our 401ks or anything else for that matter. I followed your advice about talking about the future with my parents. I got to use your session as a jumping off point to talk to my mother, who's a regular volunteer, and shared with her the comment you made about how talking about finances now rather than trying to work through paperwork later would give me a chance to mourn rather than grumble about all the paperwork I had to wade through. It seemed to make her think a little bit more about this, and I think that is a wonderful thing. I'm sure it will take several more conversations, but at least it got the ball rolling. You may be a miracle worker. Isn't that great? It's kind of fun. You know what? And so, like, having these conversations about life insurance, estate planning, whether it's with, you know, whether you're talking about this stuff with, you know, money and your kids, maybe it's money and your parents, money with your spouse, it's a process. It's a process. And you have to walk through that process and know that, you know what, some days it's going to feel like you're on the right track. Some days your mom or your kid's going to be a pain in the neck. I mean, to tell you, it is a tough topic. Money is concrete. All of our emotional stuff gets poured into that concrete thing. So I applaud everyone for taking the opportunity to talk to parents, to talk to kids, to talk to spouses, to talk to siblings. And just know that you're going to probably have to have more than one conversation. But it will be worth it. It really will be. So let's try that. Let's try conversations. Ah, the key to every good relationship, Mark. That's why we talk so much. That's why our relationship is so good. I bet you wish we talked a little less. All right. When we come back, we're going to take more of your questions. 855-411-JILL. Send us an email. AskJill@JillOnMoney.com. We'll be right back. Thanks again to Adam Levin. Lock down that identity and be on guard, ladies and gentlemen. This is with us. I'm sorry. I wish I could tell you otherwise. But, you know, when I was growing up outside of New York, we used to leave our door wide open. And you know what? Then one day my dad came home and he says, there's a lot of crime in New York City. I think we should lock the front door. So we did. And not that there were any incidents, but we just did that. And what Adam is talking about, these are things you need to do. This is locking your front door. We've sort of blissfully tried to go through our lives ignoring this threat, but the threat is real. So lock your door. Do what he says. Okay? Let's do one last email before we close out the program. Pamela writes, due to an act of God, we had two homeowners insurance claims in this year. One involved a tree falling on our garage and fence. The second was hail damage to two garages and our home. The insurance company canceled us. Is this legal? I didn't know the answer to this, so I actually had to go figure it out. It is. The most common reasons that your insurance might get canceled is because you do something stupid, like you don't pay your premiums. But also, filing too many claims, having a bad credit score, owning aggressive pets, you have a pool. I mean, these are things that are, this is such a drag, but yeah. So when you look at those reasons, and if you're wondering, you know, if you're what to do, you're going to have to just go out and shop it around. But those are the biggies. Those companies are required to notify you in advance of when they plan to cancel a policy. There are different laws. Check your states, but be aware. Yes, that can happen. I'm sorry it happened to you. All right, that's it. That's the show. Thanks again for listening. Tune in next week because it's going to be all about college financial aid. Yep, it's that time of year. Jill on Money, 855-411-JILL. Send us an email. Ask Jill at jillonmoney.com. Say hi to Mark. He is the best producer in the world. We'll see you next week.